You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, great to have Toby Young on the program, the founder and general secretary of the Free Speech Union in the United Kingdom. Toby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Happy to be here.
And welcome to New Zealand. Is this your first visit or you've been here before?
No, it's my first visit. I went to Australia with my father at the age of 11 for a kind of two-week tour. But no, apart from that, I've never been down to this part of the world.
Well, welcome. Great to have you down here. You're leading such an important piece of work. I'm a great free speech advocate myself. So I'm going to start really, really broad. In fact, it's two questions. One is, why is free speech important? I don't think we can ever stop reminding people of that. And then secondly, why did you set up the Free Speech Union or the FSU about four or so years ago? You talk us through both of those. Why is free speech important and what led you to set up the union in the UK?
Yeah, well, I can think of at least three reasons. I may think of more in the course of answering the question why free speech is important. First of all, it's the lifeblood of democracy. We can't hope to make informed decisions of who to vote for. We can't hope to hold our elected politicians to account if we don't have free speech. Often there are really important debates, schisms within our societies. And unless we can talk them through, unless we can engage in a free and open discussion about them, then they're just going to continue to fester and become more and more divisive. That's the first reason. It's an essential component of a successful, flourishing democracy. The second is, well, we need free speech in our universities, in our science laboratories, because without academic freedom, then we're not going to advance the frontiers of knowledge. If people are inhibited about publicizing findings that they believe to be scientifically true because they're worried they might get into trouble for doing so, then that's going to retard the evolution, the development of knowledge. So it's absolutely essential for the production of knowledge, which is why the free speech crisis in our universities is so serious. And I think the third reason I'd say it's really important is that it's like a canary in the mine shaft. When a regime starts suppressing free speech, when they try and shut down dissidents, opponents, critics, that is a bellwether. That's the first sign that they are descending into totalitarianism. We need to keep a vigilant eye on free speech, because if we don't, if we allow the authorities to start punishing dissidents and critics, then that is the beginning of the end of democracy.
So why is it, one of the questions I'd written down sort of I thought we'd be tying up on, but we've leapt straight into it. What is driving then people to want to limit free speech? Because I mean, look, I agree with you on those three points. It makes absolute sense. But do you think, well, what is driving that authoritarian push? Let's take it in the academic space. Why is it that they do want to suppress different views?
Yeah, well, I guess there's a charitable explanation and a less charitable explanation. If we're just talking about the academy, I guess the charitable explanation is that some misguided people believe that if certain points of view are allowed to be expressed in the university, they're going to upset historically disadvantaged, marginalized, vulnerable identity groups. So if you allow Nigel Farage to come and rail against mass immigration at Cambridge University, students from overseas, students from historically disadvantaged groups are going to be incredibly traumatized by that, traumatized and upset. It's going to make it difficult for them to do the work that they're there to do. So there's a kind of safetyist argument that we have to prioritize the safety, the mental well-being of these vulnerable groups. That's the kind of safetyist argument we hear a lot. And I think the counter to that argument is, by protecting vulnerable groups from hearing opinions they may find disagreeable, even upsetting, you're not in the long run doing them any favors. First of all, it's condescending to assume that they're not perfectly capable of fighting back, of rebutting offensive views, things they disagree with. But more fundamentally, if people don't develop the ability to withstand a bit of criticism, if they don't become mentally resilient when hearing things they find offensive and upsetting, then that's a recipe for kind of infantilizing them, for leaving them vulnerable to any kind of conflict they might encounter when they leave university. Part of the benefit, surely, of going to university is building up a kind of an immunity to hearing upsetting, disagreeable, offensive points of view, learning how to rebut them, how to get into the arena and fight back, not protecting people from that, because, you know, that's not going to set them up to thrive in the outside world when they're bound to hear many disagreeable things. I think the less charitable explanation is that, you know, free speech used to be a left-wing cause, including in universities. It's become less so as the left has become more and more powerful. The long march through the institutions has meant that people on the left are now in control. They are now the academic establishment. And so it's no longer in their self-interest to defend free speech. On the contrary, they can use various mechanisms to suppress free speech, to shut down criticism of the ideology they think it's their mission on earth to promote. As social justice advocates, they think it's going to help their cause if anyone dissenting from that particular ideology is punished and cancelled. It's often a combination of the two, and the people making the argument for banning Nigel Farage from coming to speak at the Cambridge Union, they often kind of shift between those two points of view. And I think when it's in your political self-interest to suppress a heretic, someone saying something you find disagreeable, someone challenging your point of view, rather than admit that the reason you want to no-platform them is to preserve your own political influence, you can persuade yourself you're doing it for more high-minded reasons. You're doing it to protect poor, weak, vulnerable people who you're going to save from having to be traumatized by this dreadful, toxic man. So I think it's often self-interest dressed up by the people doing the silencing as an act of charity.
Yeah, and sadly, well, we often talk, and sure you have, is pulling up the ladder. As you say, free speech has enabled such great benefits to our societies over many years. One even thinks of the civil rights movement. But yeah, now a lot of those people have been through that long march that you said through the institutions, manifesting certainly in the academic space, they're pulling up the ladder. And one thing that's always struck me, they don't seem to do the thought experiment, Toby, that if something a person is saying, you mentioned Nigel Farage, is upsetting a group of people, then surely in reverse is happening as well, that maybe their views are upsetting to him, but it doesn't seem to matter. Offence seems to only go in one direction. And as a free speech advocate, I'm sure there's many things that offend you, upset you, but you go, they're allowed to. That's mature.
Yes. Yes. And I think the radical progressive left, who are responsible for no platforming, cancelling, silencing so many people on the grounds that what they're saying may prove to be offensive or upsetting to vulnerable groups, to religious and ethnic minorities, they've exposed themselves as not really trying to suppress people they find disagreeable for these altruistic reasons, to protect people. They've exposed themselves by defending the right of pro-Palestinian protesters to protest outside synagogues, to chant from the river to the sea, to demand an intifada. That is clearly deeply traumatic and offensive to Jewish people. The Jews are a religious minority. Why should their feelings be any less important than the feelings of Muslims, say, who might get upset by Nigel Farage's presence at a university? But as you say, they're it's one group is sacred and vulnerable and is deserving of our protection. Other groups, much less so. And the fact that the radical progressive left has been so careless about the impact of the pro-Palestinian protests on our Jewish communities suggests that they don't really care about upsetting, traumatizing a beleaguered minority. That's just a rhetorical device for camouflaging their real motive, which is just to shut down their opponents.
Sadly, and I'm sure you've heard about it as you've doing your tour, we've had the same dynamics here. It says me to you, it's that intersectionality problem that you end up rating who is or is not as much offended. And at the moment, particularly our Jewish community in New Zealand are under pretty, at times, violent attack. And yes, as you say, the usual advocates are nowhere to be seen. Free speech is the same, hold on a moment, be consistent. But it is quite striking where that sort of progressive side has gone and chosen to be quite silent. So, I mean, what led you then to set up the Free Speech Union in the UK? What was the catalyst?
Well, I was cancelled myself in 2018. I was an early victim of cancel culture. I was appointed to a new regulator of higher education in England by the then Prime Minister, Theresa May. It was called the Office for Students, and it was a nothing burger of a job. I was one of 15 non-executive directors. We were due to meet four times a year, had very little power on this regulator, but because it was a public regulator, I was formally appointed by the Prime Minister. The Guardian, our largest circulation liberal newspaper, got it into its head that I had a far more important role than I really did and described me as Theresa May's new universities czar. And that was an open invitation to offence archaeologists to comb through everything I'd said or written dating back 30 years, looking for things to be outraged and offended by so they could dredge them up to demonstrate I wasn't a suitable person to be Theresa May's universities czar. And because I'd been a fairly provocative, controversial journalist throughout my career, it didn't take them long to discover a Tutankhamun's tomb's worth of supposedly offensive material to dredge up. And after 8 days of being in the eye of this Twitter storm, I decided to step down and apologize for some of the more sophomoric things I'd said on X late at night after a couple of glasses of wine, imagining naively that this would draw a line under the affair and I could just return to my ordinary life. But actually, that was like throwing a hunk of raw meat to a shoal of piranha fish. The blood was in the water and they came for me in my four other positions, and I ended up having to step down from five positions. And I remember at the time when I was watching my career burning to the ground, desperately wanting an impartial professional organization I could reach out to that would give me good advice about how to cope. Is there anything I can do to put out this fire? Should I go out there on the airwaves to defend myself, or is it better to lie doggo? Should I apologize, or will that make things worse? Is there anyone who can provide me with psychological counseling? Because, boy, this is pretty traumatic. And there was no organization like that out there. So when the dust had settled and I'd recovered, I decided to create that organization, and that was the Free Speech Union.
Look, so importantly needed, and I know it's inspired New Zealand's setting up here because there's been such a big gap. Look, one thing I learned in my own political career, and it's not that you don't apologise for things that are duly to be apologised for, but in this cancel culture space, the thought of giving a little bit of ground and that they'll give up doesn't work. They just keep coming and coming. They want to destroy you because it's not just, and feel free to push back on this, but it's not just that you've said something wrong. They make the moral leap that you're wrong, you're bad, and therefore you have to be cancelled, not just your ideas. It's insidious.
Yes. I mean, one of the things about outrage mobs when they come for you that many people misunderstand, and something we really have to drive home when people come to us for help, and we've helped over 2,500 people in the last 4.5 years, one of the things we have to get clear to them is that there is no possibility of redemption in the woke church. There is no mechanism by which you can be accepted back into the community of respectable people. It doesn't matter how much you apologize, how much you atone for your sins. In the woke church, there's no distinction between the sin and the sinner. Once you're a malefactor, once you have trampled on one of their sacred values, they just want to destroy you. And if you abase yourself at their feet and plead for mercy, they will just take that as a sign of weakness and, you know, start erecting the gallows.
Yeah, well, I've spoken on this before, of sort of new priesthood, the new dogma, and effectively you're burnt alive in the square because, as you say, there's no redemption. I mean, one of the cases which locals, there's a couple of cases that locals have been following here. One's around Sam Malia. I think he's controversial views, but well, what's happening to him? It might be easier to put it that way.
Yeah, well, Sam Malia is a right-wing activist who was prosecuted in the UK quite recently for breaching the Public Order Act. And he was found guilty of intending to stir up hatred, as well as conspiring to commit criminal damage. And his sin was that he produced various stickers and encouraged his followers and supporters to mass produce these stickers and stick them on public property. That was the conspiring to commit criminal damage part. And these stickers contained slogans like White Lives Matter and some more kind of obviously inflammatory slogans. And even though none of these stickers, as far as I know, were actually manufactured and used, he was found guilty of intending to stir up racial hatred, and which is an offence under the Public Order Act 1996. And at the Free Speech Union, we make it a point not to defend people who've clearly broken the law. We just defend people who get into trouble for exercising their right to lawful free speech. And sometimes, you know, it's not open and shut and it's a grey area and we will defend them. We didn't end up going to bat for Sam Melia, partly because he didn't reach out to us until he'd been convicted. And we did offer to help with an appeal, but his legal team never responded. But I do think that prosecuting people for intending to stir up hatred is a step too far. I much prefer the Supreme Court of the US's principle that speech within certain boundaries, like without permitting child pornography or libel or betrayal of state secrets, provided you're not doing any of those things, speech should be permitted unless it's going to lead to imminent lawless action. And that's the kind of First Amendment gold standard. If you can't show that someone saying what they've said or what they want to say is going to cause imminent lawless action, then they should be permitted to say it under the First Amendment. And we used to have the same principle in the UK, which is the common law breach of the peace principle. Within those same limits, you should be allowed to say whatever you like, provided it's not going to lead to a breach of the peace. And the First Amendment is really just the American version of that English common law principle. But we've departed from that, and we now prosecute people for intending to, in effect, breach the peace, not just breaching the peace. And I think that is a threat to free speech. And in the long term, I would like to see that law repealed, but that's extremely ambitious. When I first set up the Free Speech Union, I naively expected that we'd be pulling back some of the restrictions on free speech, cutting away some of these vines to allow people to speak more freely. But actually, most of our legal work, our legislative work, is directed at stopping things from getting any worse rather than making them any better.
And if I might add to it as well, the inconsistencies around this are glaring, that we have people on the streets of the UK and here in New Zealand explicitly calling for revolutions, intifada, killing groups of people, and nothing's happening. And by the way, you know, it's that consistent approach, but it's the inconsistency, which I have to say drives me mad. I'm also seeing a number of your politicians, I'm conscious of your time, so we better begin to wrap up, but a number of your MPs, is it Rosie, I'm looking at my notes here, Rosie Dudfield's cancelling her appearances, is it Dave Cappenail is deselected because of his views, Mike Freer's an MP who's stepping away because of the abuse that they're suffering. Is this of alarm to you and the Free Speech Union there in the UK of how your politicians are reacting to the, if you will, the abuse that's happening to them and their inability, importantly, Toby, to speak? Because that's what they want to do. They want to speak. They fear they can't.
Yes, well, I mean, I think it is an issue, and it would be callous to not take seriously people who are leaving the political arena because they find the abuse they get, particularly on social media, in the end takes too great a toll. But I'm not sure that I would invoke that as a reason to police social media more vigorously and stop people saying things which at the moment are perfectly lawful, but which may be upsetting or offensive to some people. I think, you know, if you're in public life, you've got to have a pretty thick skin. That doesn't mean you have to put up with death threats or people harassing you outside your constituency office. Of course it doesn't. But if people are, you know, being rude about you, saying offensive things about you on social media, I think unpleasant though that is just part of the price you pay for being in public life.
And I totally agree. As someone who's been in politics, you expect robust behaviour. I think there's just the irony at times, in my observation, that, yeah, the free speech of some individuals has been shut down by the very people who are calling for hate speech laws. They seem to be the same people who will turn up to your hustings and abuse you and basically try to de-platform you. Hey, last question, because I know you have to go, is can you quickly talk us through the debanking? I think that's what you call it in the UK. There's been attempts, I think, for the Free Speech Union itself, Nigel Farage last year, banks withdrawing services, and you've successfully pushed back on that.
Yes. PayPal, who we were quite dependent on, cancelled the Free Speech Union's account. Didn't give us any notice, didn't give us a proper explanation, just told us that they were shutting down our account. And I fought back. I managed to persuade something like 100 MPs and members of the House of Lords to write to the then Business Secretary, Jacob Rees-Mogg, to object to this and to write to the chairman of the Treasury Select Committee. And in the end, the head of PayPal Europe was hauled before the Financial Conduct Authority, and the business secretary condemned what they'd done in the Daily Telegraph. And as a result of that political pressure and pressure from the regulator, PayPal backed down and restored our account. But lots of people without my connections have been debanked, even some quite influential, powerful figures like Nigel Farage, probably the most famous case. He was debanked by Coutts, and again, they fobbed him off with an excuse. They didn't tell him the real reason, which was that they disapproved of his politics. He submitted a subject access request and discovered that that was the reason. And in the end, the chairman of the Coutts parent bank, NatWest, was forced to resign, and the CEO of NatWest resigned as well. No, the chairman of Coutts resigned and the CEO of NatWest resigned. Anyway, so it was a big victory for Nigel, and the Free Speech Union has been lobbying the government since then to make debanking much more difficult. We really don't want to see the emergence of a Chinese-style social credit system in the West. We saw Trudeau try to take advantage of his power to debank people participating in the trucker protest in Canada. That was a dreadful abuse of power. In China, people are kept in line, forced to toe the ideological line, because if they don't, they could lose access to banking facilities. And that's a very powerful tool of ideological enforcement. And we really don't want to see it in widespread use, any use at all across the West. And we did persuade the Conservative government to change the payment services regulations to make debanking much, much more difficult. But unfortunately, that particular piece of legislation, which was sort of in the parliamentary sausage machine, fell by the wayside when Rishi Sunak called a snap election a few weeks ago. So unfortunately, we're going to have to resume that campaign after the general election. But I think ultimately we will succeed. I don't think there's much political support either on either side of the aisle for debanking.
I'm pleased to hear that. I mean, look, it's insidious, that level of coercion. It's one, I am not in agreement with deplatforming, or as you say, no platforming people, but to take away their ability to bank it, it has all the hallmarks of those totalitarian regimes that we see in the likes of China. Toby, it's so great to have you down here in New Zealand. I know that you have some more talks to go. I'll be making sure to put those up on our social media pages so people know where to find you. But if I could also say thank you for the advocacy that you've led, including around the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act in the UK. I think that's sad that we need it, but really grateful for the leadership you've done there, because it flows down to New Zealand. We look, I think, quite closely to what you do. So very, very grateful for all your work and advocacy.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.